Today, Black Swan Squared, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 1st of February 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's digest, we look at the fallout from the coronavirus, central banks not cutting rates, yield curve inversions, and the wider economic fallout. Uncertainty and risks are on the rise, both globally and locally. And we'll start with the wider scene, but if you want to jump to the Australian section, the time code is shown below. Wall Street's major averages tumbled more than 1.5% on Friday, its worst week in 6 months. After suffering its biggest one-day percentage decline since October the 2nd, the S&P 500 is down more than 3% from its closing highs earlier in January. The uncertainty around the coronavirus is the spark, but it also gives an excuse for the market to pull back from overstretched highs as sluggish US economic data and a mixed bunch of corporate earnings fueled concerns about global growth more generally. Oh, and Donald Trump looks like he's set for a speedy acquittal by a friendly Senate in his impeachment trial. On the virus, the numbers are rising, with 259 people in China dead, and it's now declared a global emergency by the World Health Organization. Fears of contagion gripped stocks amid growing doubt about whether China can contain the outbreak, with more than 10,000 cases reported globally so far. Economists fear that the coronavirus could have a bigger impact than severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, which killed about 800 people between 2002 and 2003 at an estimated cost of $33 billion to the global economy, since China's share of the world economy is now far greater. In the US, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention said it had issued a quarantine order for all Americans repatriated from China to an Air Force base in California, despite the agency director Robert Redford saying the risk to the US public was low. Delta Airlines lost 2.38%, and American Airlines fell 3.17% after the companies said they would suspend all flights to mainland China. And the US has issued a do not travel advisory to China. US data showed consumer spending rose steadily in December, while wage gains indicated moderate growth in consumption amid contracting business investment, which added to the growth concerns. Additionally, the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index jumped to 42.9, well below forecasts of 48.8. That was the lowest read since September 2015, as the slump in manufacturing activity continues. The data shows that consumption was soft, rising at 1.8% down from 3.2%, and disappointing forecasts for a 2% increase. Residential investment was the strongest in a couple of years, as we've seen with housing starts, but trade, as in net exports, contributes 1.48 percentage points to the fourth quarter GDP, the most in a decade. Imports fell sharply, and this is probably not sustainable. Inventories shaved growth by nearly 1.1 percentage points. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 2.09% to 28,251. The S&P 500 lost 1.77% to 3,225. And the Nasdaq Composite dropped 1.59% to 9,150. It was a sea of red, although Amazon was a beacon of hope, surging 7.38% to 2008 on better-than-expected results for a holiday quarter that pushed it back into the $1 trillion market capitalization club. The financials index slid back to 504.03, with banks hit. For example, Goldman Sachs dropped 2.61% to 237.75, and Visa fell 4.44% after its quarterly revenue missed estimates and the payments network warned of incentives hitting 2020 results. Oil majors ExxonMobil and Chevron Corporation were the primary drags on the sector, as each dropped by more than 4% after disappointing results. For the week, the Dow fell 2.5%, the S&P lost 2.1%, and the Nasdaq declined 1.8%. Both the Dow and the S&P 500 had their worst weekly performances since early August. For the month, the Dow lost 1%, the S&P slipped 0.2%, and the Nasdaq rose 2%. As you would expect, the volatility index was way up to 1884, a movement of 21.63% on the day. So fear stalks the halls again. The benchmark 10-year yields are edging lower, down to 1.505, which is down 3.21%, while the 30-year slipped 1.43% to 1.997. But the three-month went to 1.556, down 0.82%. So we are back in yield curve inversion territory, as we discussed in our recent post. This is all about a safe haven rally given the virus risks and weaker economic growth. The Fed held the cash rate, and Chairman Jerome Powell reiterated the central bank's policy of symmetric inflation targeting. That translates into allowing inflation rates to rise above the Fed's 2% target for a sustained period to make up for recent periods when it ran below 2%. And he also said that they would ease back on their open market operations in the months ahead.
Just to bring you back, after last September's brief turmoil, we took prompt and decisive action, and as a result, money markets have been operating smoothly since then. Just to review, those two adjustments were Treasury bill purchases of at least into the second quarter, and term and overnight repo at least through April. And I will get to your specific question. The purpose of the adjustments has been to assure that our policy is transmitted smoothly to the federal funds rate, which requires well-functioning money markets. That doesn't mean we're trying to eliminate all volatility in the repo markets. We know that some volatility is normal and expected in well-functioning markets. And as I mentioned, these adjustments have been successful in supplying an ample quantity of reserves. Money markets operated smoothly, including right through year-end, and the Fed funds rate has remained in our target range. So we will know when these adjustments have run their course, when reserves are durably at a level that enables us to control the federal funds rate using our administered rates, interest on reserves, and reverse repo, without the need for frequent use of open market operations. Based on current projections, we expect that the bill purchases will durably bring the underlying level of reserves to the ample level sometime in the second quarter of this year. And when we see that we've reached that level, we'll begin to gradually reduce our asset purchases to the level of the underlying trend growth of demand for our liabilities. As our bill purchases bring the underlying level of reserves up to an ample level on a sustained basis, the necessary quantity of overnight and term repo will gradually decline. We've already begun the gradual reduction in the quantity of repo, and we'll continue to reduce those offering amounts gradually as conditions permit. At some point, we'll also raise the minimum bid rate. Even after we reach an ample level of reserves, it's possible that repo operations might play a role as a backstop and support effective control of the federal funds rate. And we'll continue to discuss that issue in reviewing our implementation.
The question is, does anyone believe Powell on this point? As on Thursday, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York pumped another $83 billion into new liquidity into the short-term lending markets. The move saved the banks from having to sort out their own illiquidity issues for another week. And Powell acknowledged that trade issues are still reducing business investment, and that was before the World Health Organization declaration. The US dollar index was down 0.51% to 97.36. Oil reacted to the easing growth expectations, with March WTI down 3.25%. And that's this week, its fourth consecutive weekly loss, closing at 51.62 and down 1% on the day. Gold was firmer, as you would expect, as it is seen as a safe haven in times of crisis. So it was up 0.33% to 1,588 on the day, and up more than 1% across the week. This reflects the notion that the gold trade is one associated with loss aversion, TD Securities said in the note, that cites gold's superior performance to stocks on Wall Street, which were on track for their first monthly loss in five. Bitcoin closed at 9,398, down 1.61% on the day, but up 11.15% over the week and up 30.17% over the month. So extreme volatility as expected, and more evidence that this is not behaving like a real currency, but as a speculative instrument. China's official PMI did not show the stress of the coronavirus, but did indicate the manufacturing sector was already vulnerable before the health crisis. The January manufacturing PMI slipped to 50 from 50.2. The non-manufacturing sector performed better, rising to 54.1 from 53.5. And the composite eased to 53 from 53.4. The officially extended Lunar New Day holiday ends on February the 2nd, but provinces and cities that account for two-thirds of the country's GDP will remain shut for about another week. And Goldman Sachs revised down China's 2020 GDP expectations to 5.5% from 5.9%, and Mihusu Securities estimates that a prolonged spread of the virus threatens to knock full-year growth in China by 0.3% to 5.6%, but GNS Economics in Finland went all out, saying it is probable that the coronavirus will push the Chinese economy into recession sometime this year. As China has led this global cycle, the rest of the world will follow. The first shoe to drop outside China is likely to be the export and China-dependent Eurozone. Many European banks will be unable to withstand a recession, they said. When the European banking crisis, driven by the ensuing recession, resumes, it will go global, fast, as Europe holds the biggest concentration of globally systemically important banks, or G-SIBs. It is also unlikely that hypervalued US stock markets will be able to endure the impact of a global recession. This is even more the case if the Fed tapers its term repo operations in February as planned. And a global recession, a European banking crisis, and a crash in the US capital markets will produce a global economic collapse, which will almost certainly overwhelm any attempt, massive and coordinated as they may be, to turn the tide by overstretched central banks and over-indebted governments. Well, there you have it. The virus's progression has been likened to a science fiction movie, replete with conspiracy theories around symptomless transmission and super spreaders. Some 60 million people at the centre of the outbreak are living under virtual lockdown. A shock to China's economy this quarter, which then reverberates through global supply chains, is a foregone conclusion. It's just that no one yet can say how deep. Investors in China will get their first chance to trade since January 23rd on Monday, when financial markets reopen. A 5% plunge in share prices in neighbouring Taiwan and Hong Kong, as soon as they opened after the Lunar New Year break, has given markets a taste of what to expect from Shanghai on Monday. Eyes will also be on the People's Bank of China to see what monetary support it might stump up. For equities, the declines are likely to be exacerbated by the amount of leverage in the market. That could create a downward spiral where steep losses become steeper as traders face margin calls. As an example of how extreme selling can be, the Shanghai equity benchmark fell almost 6% in May when it resumed trading following a holiday break on negative trade war news. Japan's retail sales disappointed, but the industrial output jumped 1.3%, its first increase in 3 months. December retail sales rose by 0.2% compared with expectations for nearly a 1% gain. Recall that retail sales plummeted in October thanks to the sales tax increase and typhoon, but surged 4.5% in November. The rise in industrial production featured a strong rise in equipment that produces flat panel displays. Nevertheless, industrial output fell around 4% in the fourth quarter and will drag GDP lower. Japanese unemployment was steady at 2.2%, a 27-year low. In the UK, at his last meeting as Bank of England governor, Mark Carney pulled the proverbial rabbit out of a hat and held the cash rate. Many observers had counted five officials that had sounded particularly dovish lately, including Carney himself. The vote was 7-2, as the previous meetings. The central bank cut its growth forecast for this year and next by 0.4% to 0.8%, and 1.4% respectively. Nevertheless, the message the market took away was one of a hawkish hold. Frankly, while Carney has done well in strengthening the banking system with higher capital, he has tended to vacillate on monetary policy. That said, UK mortgage lending rose at its highest rate since the referendum to leave the EU back in 2016. The FTSE was off 0.94% on Friday as it reacted to the virus scare to close at 7,286 and is down nearly 4% across the week. The financials index was down 0.94% to 773.45, and sterling rose 0.86% against the US dollar to 1.3207. The UK officially left the EU after a turbulent 47 years of membership, but this just moves the country into the exit waiting area as negotiations on trade and other issues commence. So this is not the end of the chaos, just a different flavour. It will have 11 months to forge a deal with its biggest trade partner, a task which is literally impossible to achieve. But if it doesn't forge a deal in this time period, the UK will have to comply with World Trade Organization standards, and that means paying tariffs. In a best-case scenario, the UK's economy is likely to shrink by 1% in terms of GDP, but under the worst-case scenario, the economy could plunge by 3%. And news from the euro area disappointed. France and Italy unexpectedly reported their economies contracted in the fourth quarter of 2019, down 0.1% and 0.3% respectively. Spain, however, surprised on the upside with a 0.5% growth rate. These national figures translated into a quarter four EMU growth of 0.1% rather than the 0.2% that economists expected, after a 0.3% expansion in the third quarter. Compounding the challenge, consumer prices fell 1% in December, while the year-over-year rate edged up to 1.4% from 1.3%, while the core rate of inflation eased to 1.1% from 1.3%. This has confused investors, as the European Central Bank has been more optimistic about the Eurozone. With the US renewing threats of raising duties last week, and the UK leaving the EU, it is difficult to digest how the bank contemplates that the risk to the outlook is less pronounced. The German retail sales number further added to the fuel. It reported a negative reading. The data came in as down 3.3% against a forecast of down 0.5%. The GDP figures for the whole of Europe will be published later on, and if we see another negative surprise, it's likely to make the sell-off even worse for the equities markets. Troubled Deutsche Bank reported a fourth quarter 2019 net loss of 1.48 billion euros due to one-offs, transformation charges of about 680 million euros, and restructuring and severance expenses of 473 million euros. Also, lower revenue and higher expenses were undermining factors, while provisions fell. However, a strong capital position and lower provisions were tailwinds. With higher interest rates still far off, banks are finding it challenging to grow. But after 20 months of downgrades, earnings estimates have started to stabilize. Yet, after an almost unrelentingly demoralizing 2019, Deutsche Bank's CEO is asking his bankers to make one last sacrifice for the sake of suing grand turnaround vision, waiting a few extra months for pay rises that were promised last year. Unsurprisingly, Sewing blamed the many scandals and penalties that have plagued Deutsche Bank, saying they hastened the need for dramatic cost cuts. But remember that the bank has paid out more than $20 billion in fines over the last decade. For the bank to be competitive and meet its goals for sustainable returns to shareholders, it is vital that we further manage costs in a disciplined manner, Sewing wrote. This also relates to compensation. Shares rose nonetheless as investors turned their focus on the bank's turnaround potential, closing at 8.42, up 0.28% on Friday. The yield on German 10-year debt has slipped in recent days, ended at minus 0.44% for the first time in 3 months on Friday. Negative rates abound. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, Please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so to the local markets. The black swan is casting a long shadow down here in Australia. Analysts from Goldman Sachs have estimated that the current pandemic outbreak could shave 0.4% off Chinese GDP, but given the scope of the response, that could be a gross underestimation of the economic impact. And the move in the Aussie suggests that currency traders are far less sanguine than the analysts about economic prospects going forward. On the more immediate front, the Aussie remained the weakest currency in the G11, dropping below the 67 cent level as coronavirus cases continue to pile up and Chinese authorities push back the factory reopenings in many regions to February the 10th. Many analysts are now saying an Aussie at 65 to 66 is quite likely ahead. And the pound Aussie dollar rallied to its highest levels since June of 2016 to below 52 cents. Not pretty. More broadly, UBS spelled out the potential issue for us. While it's too early to know the full impact of the coronavirus, it is clearly another negative for the economy on top of the catastrophic bushfires. While there are some comparisons to SARS in 2003, the economic link between Australia and China is multiples larger now. In 2003, Australian exports to China were only $11 billion, or 7% of the total, or 1.3% of GDP, but it's now $152 billion, or 32% of exports, and 7.8% of GDP. The potential impact could now be much more significant. With the Chinese government recently announcing a halt on all outbound group tourists for a minimum of 2 months, tourism and travel could be a key sector impacted. In 2003, short-term arrivals from China were only 200,000 per annum, or 7% of share, but they're now around 1.5 million, or 19%. Indeed, by value, Chinese visitors are around 30%, or $20 billion, of total inbound tourism, and they estimate that 70%, or $3.3 billion, of this spending is from group tours. Given that February and March are two of the busiest months for Chinese travellers to Australia's, about a quarter of annual arrivals, they estimate the cost from the halt could be at least $1 billion. However, if travel disruptions are extended or expand to cover independent travellers, the cost would be much greater. As a small open economy, Australia is highly vulnerable to global growth. A 3-point decline from current levels in the global manufacturing PMI to around 47 will be followed by a fall in Australia's GDP, slower employment growth, and lower inflation. So they believe this could eventually prompt the RBA to quickly cut the cash rate to its effective lower bounds of 25 basis points. And fears of an increase in the contagion of the coronavirus have been causing a sell-off in the Australian dollar across the board. It closed at 66.88 on Friday and is down 5% over the past month. The headline employment data was better than expected, and it gave the pair a temporary bounce, but the Australian economy is directly tied to China's economy. And China is a large import of Australian goods and services. Therefore, if China's economy is to slow down because of the coronavirus, the Australian economy may slow down as well. And there have already been talks of the virus knocking off up to 2% from China's first quarter GDP. Businesses are temporarily shutting down. Airlines are halting flights to China for as long as 3 months. All of this is causing a slowdown in China and therefore a potential slowdown in Australia. In addition, the latest inflation data is not helping. Earlier, Australia released its producer price index for the fourth quarter. The actual print was 0.3% versus a 0.5% expectation and a 0.4% previous. Add bad economic data into the mix, and it's a recipe for the Australian US dollar to trade lower into the weekend and ahead. So do house prices. The CoreLogic Home Price Index continued its seemingly inevitable upward path, with prices in Sydney and Melbourne up more than 1% and annually up around 8%, though Perth is down 5.7%. The trends, though, are showing falls from the peaks in Sydney, Melbourne and Perth, and the rate of growth continues to decline, according to our trending tracker. As I discussed yesterday, discussing the still weak lending data, see our post, credit growth stirs perhaps. I do not find this convincing, given the data we continue to see. This is some weird parallel world where low transaction volumes skewed towards the more expensive end of the market are bending the results, at least in our view. The chief Australian economist at BAX Oxford Economics, Dr. Sarah Hunter, believes that rental growth will remain weak until the end of 2021 or early 2022 because the number of building approvals have found their trough in the current cycle, meaning the number of new buildings coming onto the market will hit rock bottom in roughly 18 months' time. But the truth is, until incomes start to rise, rents will grind lower, meaning investors will continue to be taken to the cleaners. No wonder investment lending is not rising. And a special Roy Morgan survey conducted in Australia in conjunction with the Gallup International Association survey in 47 countries worldwide finds that Australia is one of the least confident countries in the world about 2020. Only 12% of Australians, down 32% on a year ago, expect 2020 to be a better year than 2019, which is equal 43rd with South Korea. Of the 47 countries surveyed, Australia is more positive about 2020 than only three countries, including Italy, 11%, Jordan, 7%, and Lebanon, 5%. Australia's traditional allies, the US and UK, fare significantly better with their views of 2020. A plurality of 43% of Americans say 2020 will be better than 2019, while a third of Britons expect 2020 will be better. And a closely watched measure of Australian business conditions showed activity weakened into the end of 2019 as confidence slipped to its lowest since mid-2013, even before the full impact of raging bushfires made itself felt. National Australia Bank's index of business conditions dipped a point to plus 3 in December, again short of the long-term average of plus 6. Conditions continue to imply a stalling in the private sector, and we think that the survey suggests that there was another weak outcome in the December quarter, said NAB Group Chief Economist Alan Oster. NAB survey showed mixed conditions across industry with large gains for wholesale and mining, offset by falls in finance and business and property services. Confidence declined in retail and construction, while the services industries were more buoyant. There was little sign of inflationary pressure, with retail prices rising a modest 0.5% in the December quarter. An economist at National Australia Bank on Thursday pushed back their forecast for further monetary easing by the country's central bank to April from their previous call for February. The move aligns NAB's forecast with financial market pricing, indicating a mere 20% chance of a 25 basis point cut to the 0.75% cash rate in February. The RBA holds its next policy meeting on February the 4th, and the market had already sharply scaled back the chance of an easing following stronger-than-expected employment reports last week. Finally, a quick market summary. The ASX settled lower at 5,822, down 0.96% over the week, but still up 5% over the month. It will likely drop further on Monday following the US. The local volatility index was up 15% over the week to 1376. The euro Aussie dollar landed at 1.6583, up 1.09%. The Aussie gold cross was up 1.41% to 2375. And the Aussie Bitcoin cross was down 1.36% on Friday to 14,004. So standing back, we are in the middle of significant events which are likely to put more pressure on both markets and the economy more widely. And of course, the bushfires are still raging in places, just to add to the pressures. With all these headwinds, I'm expecting more weakness in the property market ahead as auctions begin to power up. So the swans are circling. And just before I finish, you might want to listen to John Adams' compelling testimony in front of the Senate hearing this week relating to the cash ban. He really did hit the ball out of the ballpark. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.